Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery, and that is why the Machinery Digest exists, a no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello, my friends, and welcome to Idle Chatter. Ray Bohax here, the Hot Rod Farmer, Cat Swamp Road, Warren County, New Jersey. So hopefully things are going well for you. I got to think of a better way to bring the intro into the show, not the music. I personally love the that soundtrack with the top fuel car making a pass down the quarter mile. But, hey, I do sincerely wish you all the best, and I want to thank you for listening. So I guess there's no other way to say that than to say hopefully things are going well for you, and thank you for being here. So what I'm going to do is I want to hopefully give you a good story. You know, when you shift gears from being a writer to a podcaster, is that my whole career was based upon writing magazine articles, writing technical papers, writing books, and then that's why I keep thinking of you as my readers instead of my listeners. So that is my my mistake. But you get so entrenched with calling someone a reader instead of a listener, and I guess people who went the other way, went from broadcasting into writing, probably call everybody a listener when they're actually a reader. So, hey, I'm just glad that you're here, whether you're listening or reading. And I do want to say one thing, and it's a shameless plug, as always, right? Because I guess if it's your show, you could plug whoever you want, but I'm not that way. But hopefully you know that I'm just joking around. I'm in a joking around type of mood today. I don't know whether that's good or bad, so I guess we'll see as the show progresses. But, read, listen, learn. That's really what the Farm Machinery Digest is all about. So right now you're listening, but there is a wealth of information on the website, farmmachinerydigest.com. And if you look under the Learn tab, that is where all of the educational material is, under the Learn tab. And you have the Learning series, which are magazine type articles, and then you have the Getting to Know, which are application specific. That's an engineering way of saying it's about something. So Duramax diesel, Powerstroke, University of Northwestern Ohio, hose end chamber. So that is the Getting to Know series. And then there is also the Lecture Hall series, which is some short audio recordings. I guess they're not really podcasts. And then we also have the Hot Rod Farmer Minute, but that is under the podcast tab. So check it out. I have my monthly blog there, which I actually enjoy writing, because it's about life and about living and about people and animals and being an American and being a farmer or what have you. So I enjoy writing those, and you may want to check them out if you and see whether you like them too. If you don't, hey, that's certainly your prerogative. You don't have to like them, but I try to use them to inspire and to show also my audience another side of me. And it's not about me, it's just showing you another side of me. And then there's also up there the toolbox test. And as you know, we've integrated a question from the toolbox test into the show each week. And that has been very, very well received. So I want to thank you all for that. And if you're not taking those tests, I suggest that you test them, take them, because they are meant to be a learning experience. And that is really what this whole mission, this whole journey is about, is education and educating you, the American farmer and rancher, to be more efficient in your operation and to spend less money on your equipment so you could spend your money where it makes you money. Broken down equipment makes you no money at all. And until we learn that as a community and recognize that, we are always going to have never reach our peak. We're never going to reach our peak efficiency because we'll be giving some stuff away. What do I mean by giving away? Giving profits out the door. And that is not good. I want you to keep your profits. I don't want you to spend them unnecessarily. If you're going to spend them on either something that's going to make money for you or something that you can enjoy doing, not just wasting it. So, but, you know, I've told you this before, and every morning, with rare exception, unless I have to go someplace or we're doing something here on the farm, and I have to start right at crack of dawn, or the weather is extremely inclement, not in the summer, but in the winter with snow and ice, is that I go down to a truck stop, which is 18.6 miles from our farm. And it's a TA truck stop in Columbia, New Jersey, right off of I-80. And I go there, and I try to leave here by 5 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes I miss that, and sometimes I don't. So I try to leave by 5 o'clock in the morning. It takes about 21, 22 minutes to get there. By the time I get out to the Interstate 80, and we're about just shy of 2 miles from Interstate 80, and then they have to get off of the interstate and go about a mile or so on the back road to get to the truck stop, even though it's right along I-80, but you cannot exit and get right there. They used to have a sign up in the truck stop saying the ins and outs of Columbia, because it is, if you don't know how to get there and get back in 80, you'll be riding around forever. But I go there and usually get there about 20 after 5 and have my coffee and go for a walk and walk around, and they have like a little, I don't want to say coffee clutch there, but I guess it's probably not much different than you know, anybody going to town to a cafe. The only thing that is different is that I'm the only person that comes to every day to get coffee and walk around. The rest of the people are transient, so my little chatted up group is with the employees, and obviously I don't talk to them too much because they're working on playing hooky. But anyway, that is the segue into what I'm saying to you. And I'm very friendly with everyone there. And the service manager, Rich, of the service end of the truck stop. So it's the TA, the service department of the truck stop, which is actually a Freightliner service point. So it seems that all of the TAs and Petros are Freightliner service points. But anyway, he started a couple month or two ago. He asked me if I ever taught any adult education classes in the college. And at first I said to him, no, I didn't. And I said, I used to teach adult education, but I said, for a company, in other words, for their dealer network. So I was teaching adults. I did that for a few companies, but specifically Axel Digital Fuel Injection was a division of Mr. Gasket. But they're out of business now. But anyway, I did that for 15 years. But I said, as far as, you know, like a class at night for somebody to come in and learn about cars or something in a local college, I said, I never did that. Then I was thinking, and I did do that once, but it was many years ago, so I kind of forgot about it. But anyway, the point that I'm getting to with all of this gibberish is that, so he ended up starting to teach a class. We just started the other day. It was his first night. It's a college class in a local community college, and they're college students. So it's not an adult education class where you come in and take the proverbial basket weaving. So it's college students in the class, and I think he said it's between 7 and 9:30 or 6 o'clock. I think 6 o'clock at night to 9:30 at night. But anyway, so I asked him the other day when I saw him, I said, how was your first class, teach? And, you know, how many students do you have? So he has 7 students in the class, which obviously is very, very small. And it's a basic introduction to auto mechanics, or introduction to mechanics. I don't even know what the title of it is. And but he said it's a basic introductory class. And the age of the students range from about 18 or 19 years old, right out of high school, or up to, I think the oldest guy is 26 or 27 years old, and it's all guys. There were seven guys. And so he asked the class on his first night trying to, break the ice and get them, get friendly with them. So he said to them, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And they all said that they want to be an auto mechanic. So I said, that's fine. That's, listening to that, that's fine. Certainly nothing wrong with that. We need good mechanics, right? But then the next thing that he said, okay, how many of you have done an oil change in your life? And two of them only changed oil, and they only did it once. And that just, like, floored me, because and I'm not saying that you can't come to something late in the game and in the life and soar. I don't want to even say succeed. I want to say soar. I'm not saying that whatsoever. But the fact of the matter is that to have somebody between 19 and 26 years old who claims that they want to be an auto mechanic, and in their whole life they didn't ever change the oil on anything, not even on the lawnmower, he said. They've never done anything. And like I say, I'm not belittling that. But the fact of the matter is that, why I'm telling you this is that, you don't realize, and I guess human beings, we don't realize oftentimes the blessings that we have and the exposure to things. I know myself, and I'm not using myself as a standard to judge others by no means, but I think I changed the first oil. That's what my father showed me how to do. I think I was 6 years old. So by the time I was their age, I had motors apart. I ported cylinder heads. We were working on farm tractors, working on cars, working on motorcycles, working on carburetors, working on alternators with generators, right? And the rear ends, differentials, brake jobs. Granted, I was no expert, but I had exposure to things. So taking out rusty bolts, learning how to not strip a bolt on, or how to not break a bolt. Learning how to tighten something in sequence. We even discussed that a couple of shows back about the pet peeves of sloppy mechanics. The proper way to clean parts, the proper way to pack a wheel bearing. And the thing is that, these young people today, and I don't know what the parents are thinking, is that, Charlotte and I have never had any children. The only children we had had either wings or paws. So I'm not going to shoot any darts at anybody. But if I were a father and we did have children, I think that you're doing your children a disservice in life by not exposing them to things and having them learn how to do things. It doesn't mean, because your son is growing up on the farm or your daughter is growing up on the farm. And I'm old school. So you want to call me a male chauvinist, call me a male chauvinist. I believe a woman should be independent, but I also believe that she should be a lady. And I think that the way God made society, it is certain that a man is supposed to take care of a girl. If he goes out on a date with your daughter, he's supposed to be able to protect her and take care of her until he brings her back home to you, and you're giving him your responsibility. That's always when I dated a girl, I always felt that this was my responsibility to protect her and care her for her and provide for her until I brought her back home to a family. These kids say they can't even change a tire. It's ridiculous. And so now the point that I'm getting at is they're starting at such a deficit, because here they are, the guy 26 years old, never changed oil, and just using, like I said, I'm not bragging by no means, but using me as an example, by the time I was 26 years old, I had 20 years of experience working on engines and machinery and building motors and diagnosing and what have you. So, based upon that, it would take him at that same rate of growth. It would take that individual till he's 46 years old to be able to get the same level of exposure. I'm not going to say even experience, exposure to things that that somebody like me or a kid growing up on a farm has. So, I really, truly, truly think, and I know people have said this before, is that I really think that the farm kids of America are the ones that are going to save this country. And if you take a farm kid and you expose him to things or her to things, and then back that up with an education, you have a child that's not only can almost not fail, but the fact of the matter is that you're taking this person and making this young person into a young adult, into an adult, into a productive part of society. instead of having somebody who knows how to do absolutely nothing. So, you know, I wish them luck. I'm not being negative about anything whatsoever, but I think it's very, very hard to be able to be a good mechanic, a good engineer, a good diagnostician, a good whatever, a good farmer with no experience whatsoever. And you learn a lot of this stuff through osmosis. So, hey, whatever. I guess that's the way of the world, and at least it is in New Jersey. But, you know, in my town over here, since I'm on this high horse, just give me another minute. You know, you could ride around. We're out in the farm, so we have no neighbors. But, you know, I could go into town. Hackettstown's a pretty big town. I think it has about 10 or 12,000 people that are in the township of Hackettstown itself. And, you know, you could ride around on a nice, we'll go into town in a nice summer or spring afternoon, right? Saturday afternoon, you know, first warm Saturday. It's 75 degrees and sunny, right? I mean, you don't see anybody outside cutting the grass. It's like that movie, The Andromeda Strain. We read that book in junior high school or in elementary school, and they made a movie about it, The Andromeda Strain. It's like everything is there, but there's nobody around. There's nobody outside. There's nobody cutting the grass. There's no one with the hood open on the car. Doesn't anybody check their oil anymore? I'm talking, I mean, this is in town. I mean, you know, and because the communities, these people have a piece of land. It's like any small town. It's not like this in an apartment building. And nobody's doing anything. That the streets are empty. There's not a kid riding a bicycle. I mean, it's crazy. And sadly, you know, I see the same thing throughout rural America. I mean, whenever I travel back roads, and you know, I go to Ohio quite a bit, to the University of Northwest Ohio. I take Route 224 through Ohio. Could be a beautiful day. You don't even see a kid outside. You see no one. I don't know what they're all playing with, the computer. So who knows? Hey, it's a different world. But the fact of the matter is, as parents, you know, if you don't expose, and I'll end with this, if you don't expose your child to something and using the ideology, well, I don't want them to be a mechanic, I don't want them to be a farmer, that's fine. They could choose to be something else in their life, even though there's nothing wrong with being a mechanic, being a farmer, being a plumber, being a welder. Those are wonderful things. The world needs those, needs that. But that doesn't mean because that your child knows how to use a wrench or change a flat tire that they're doomed to a life of servitude, of staying on the side of the road and swinging a wrench. I mean, it's ridiculous. So who knows? But, you know, the chasm that we're causing here is that everything is getting so more technically advanced, farm equipment more technically advanced, cars, engines, refrigerators, everything is more technically advanced, and yet we're not bringing society along with it. One part of it is going to the left, the other part is going to the right, and that's not going to be good for the country. It's not going to be good in any way, shape, or form. So, all right, I'm up on my high horse. Thank you for letting me hear it. But if you're on the farm, you have children, boys, girls, right? That's wonderful. And the thing is that the education that they could get on that farm, the real-life practical experience, cannot be bought anywhere at any. I don't care if you go to Harvard. And then if they take that education, that real-life practical experience, and go to school and apply the science, the mathematics to it, whatever it may be, then you have the possibility of a moonshot. You have, like I said, my New Year's failure is not an option. They're not going to fail. And they're going to be an asset not only to themselves, they're going to make you proud. They're going to be an asset to you, to your farm, to their family, and to their children, if they have children, and to our country. So, enough said. So, hey, you're not coming here for a sermon, right? But it is time now for Bushels and Cents. And I want to drive home the message that success on the farm or ranch is a three-legged stool: agronomy, marketing, and machinery. The best way is to establish how a poor decision or inaccurate diagnosis of a machinery issue costs your operation money. But instead of referencing just dollars, I will reference it in crop, corn at $3.50 a bushel. And never forget, it's not what you make, but what you keep that counts. All right. You are the type of person that does not believe in keeping the fuel tank of your vehicles full. It is always between one half and one eighth. With only 50,000 miles, the fuel pump fails on your pickup truck. 100 miles from town. Wonderful, right? After a long wait for a $300 tow job back to the dealer and a $500 repair bill, the truck is fixed. Many do not recognize that the fuel level in the tank is the coolant for the pump. When the level is always low, the pump runs hotter and fails prematurely. You wrote a check for $800. That's the $300 tow job and $500 for an in-tank fuel pump with labor and parts, which is not very, very, very realistic and could be even more. And that is the equivalent of 229 bushels of corn. And you also wasted an entire day. What is that worth? Let this not be you. So keep that in mind. You want to keep those fuel tanks. You could run it down low and then fill it back up. But the people and you know anything that has an in-tank electric fuel pump, whether it's a piece of farm equipment, has a lift pump in the tank, or whether it's a generator set, or whether it's anything, car, truck, pickup truck, I don't care what it is. If it has an in-tank fuel pump, that fuel pump, that fuel in that tank, gasoline or diesel, is meant to be a coolant for that pump. And if you have a constant duty cycle, it's operating cycle. Duty cycle is an operating cycle where it is always partially exposed, half exposed, three quarters exposed. That pump is going to run hotter. And over time, that higher running temperature is going to degrade that pump and have it fail prematurely. So fill it up. And if you don't, if you're the type of person where you don't want to put $100 in the gas tank or $50 in the gas tank, fill it up one time, bite the bullet, and then when it gets down to a quarter, I mean three quarters or half, fill it back up again. It's not going to cost you any more money. It's not going to go, you're not going to lay out any more money, and you're going to increase the life of that fuel pump. Now, some people in the industry have calculated that on a farm, especially during planting, that your time is worth about $800 an hour. And they have this, they have these business calculations that they look at and the, versus the gold, the crop yield and what have you. So, but an industry standard is $800 an hour for you to run that operation. So the thing basically is this guy was sitting on the side of the road for almost a day. All right, had a $300 tow job, a $500 fuel pump, and he lost an entire day. So you could actually put the $800 into that if you wanted to, but I did not. I just figured the amount of bushels in corn for the check he wrote, not counting what his time is worth. And one of the things in business, I don't care what business it is, if you think your time is worth nothing, it is worth nothing, and that's going to be a problem for you as you try to move forward. All righty. Now, excuse me, we're going to get back. I'm yelling and getting all choked up here. I'm going to take a drink of water, so I'm going to be quiet for a second. Okay, here I am. So, I apologize for that. All righty, what today's show is about 23 minutes into the show. Is that, you know, last week we were talking about how to employ, how to put into service an older tractor, and do away with all of the complexity. I'm not going to say problems, but complexity with a newer tractor. And as I said last week, a lot of people are doing that. And they're applying that logic mostly to their farm equipment, but also trucks, what have you. You know, farm trucks, grain that they use for grain, and whatever they're doing, hauling cattle. So today we're going to go to the polar opposite, and we're going to talk about newer equipment, and specifically what I'm going to talk about is the SCR system. Now, SCR stands for Selective Catalytic Reduction. All right, so sometimes I'll refer to it, and hopefully I don't slip up in this show today, and call it and call it supplemental catalytic reduction instead of selective. And it's not that I do not know the term, but since I was always involved with this and exposed to it, that back early on, many years ago, about 20 years ago, when they were starting to talk about bringing in Tier 4 emissions, and then an SCR, Selective Catalytic Reduction System, is only found on Tier 4, and later we're going to be approaching Tier 5 soon, Tier 5 emission systems. And they called it, they were thinking about calling it supplemental catalytic reduction, but that name got buried early on. But I was the one who was, I would say, I was exposed to it. I wasn't the one who was involved. I was exposed to it, reading about it and studying about it and learning about it. And the thing is that early on, so in my mind, I still call it supplemental. And the reason why they were considered calling it supplemental was because there was going to be a diesel oxidation catalyst and a diesel particulate filter prior to the SCR. So they were saying it was a supplement to that. Right, but then they changed it. The SAE got together, Society of Automotive Engineers, and decided that the industry term was going to be selective. And why it is called selective catalytic reduction is just like you would have a selective herbicide, let's say like a 2,4-D, right, that's going to kill a broadleaf but not kill a grass. But the thing basically is that you can have a selective herbicide, is that the SCR system is selectively working on one pollutant, and that is oxides of nitrogen. It's not working on hydrocarbons. It's not working on carbon monoxide. And it's effective, and it's not effective on particulate matter. So it is selective, just like you would use a selective herbicide. Now, the impetus for me to do this show was not last week's show about saying farm and old equipment, but older equipment. I'm not saying 1920 tractor, but the thing is that what the frustration, and that really is the impetus for me to not only the impetus for the show, but the impetus for me to have started this podcast and the website, is that there is no transfer of knowledge, or very minimal transfer of knowledge as far as equipment is concerned. And the thing is that same thing is happening in the auto industry. I mean, you could go to the average, dealer mechanic, even a guy who's a very good mechanic and a well-respected technician. They're not mechanics, but they call them technicians. And the thing basically is that they ask them about how something works, and they're not training the guys how it works. They're trying to plug into the computer and do this. If it has a code, follow the book and the code, that's it. And that's it. And then do whatever. And if it doesn't work, call the helpline, and then some guy who doesn't know what the heck he's talking about will tell you what to do. And that's the reality of it. I can tell you stories about those helplines. But anyway, so the frustration is that, for me, is that I wanted to do a show and start to bring my audience into understanding how to diagnose a SCR system, selective catalytic reduction, which uses diesel exhaust fluid, which is basically deionized water mixed with automotive grade urea, which is a urea fertilizer, but it's an automotive grade urea, which is called diesel exhaust fluid. And so I wanted to bring two things to light. And this is going to be a journey with us. So I'm not going to say there's going to be a part two next week or a month from now, but it's going to be a journey, and I want to bring you along because I want you to have to understand not only how to diagnose these systems, but I also want you to be able to use the system itself as a diagnostic tool. And what do I mean by that? And I'm going to go ahead of myself, and I'm going to come backwards. And what I mean by it is that I check everything, all right? I check the gas mileage, every tank full of my car, when home heating oil, when I fill up have the tank filled up, and then I divide out by how many days and how many gallons the unit used, like you would calculate gas mileage. If you listen to my show a month or so ago, I have a monitor. I monitor the line voltage and the frequency of the voltage coming into the house here. All right. When I have my generator, if power goes out, when I have my generator running. All right. And we do have a special delivery question about generator today, which I think is kind of cool. But I monitor the AC, I monitor the voltage, I monitor the frequency. So the thing basically is that by you being familiar, and you don't have to be paranoid with this, but, you know, it's just like, you know, like anything. The farmer who never goes out in his field and he plants the seed and he comes to the end of the row, pulls the lever to plant, that picks up, and he drives out of the field never to look back again until harvest time, usually is not going to be the one that has the best yield. All right? So that's usually not going to be the case. But the fact of the matter is, by looking at numbers, looking at things and checking them, and like I say, that you have an indicator of things, whether they're going right or they're going wrong. So in essence, I know, like using my oil burner in the house, at the peak of the winter, which is usually about now, our coldest weather around from the middle end of January through like the end of February, and if we have a real cold snap, my oil burner will use about 5 gallons a day. All right, so I know when I calculate when I get my oil fill, I'm not looking at it on a daily basis. I'll say, geez, I'll average about 5 gallons a day for that tank of oil. So that means if it was a warmer day, I only use 3, and some days I use 7, but I know that I have an average of 5. And just like if you go across the field with a combine and you're harvesting corn, you say, well, you may have a spot in the corn that has 400 bushels per acre, another spot that has 120 bushels per acre, and then you have an average of 300 bushels per acre. So that's your field average. So by assigning numbers to things, you are able to have a good indicator of what's going right or possibly something that is going wrong. So now what I'm saying is that if you monitor the diesel exhaust fluid consumption on your equipment that uses it, right, with an SCR, and you say this thing usually uses so many gallons per 100 gallons of fuel, then you have, okay, fine. You know, now I used to use 5 gallons per 100 gallons of fuel. Now I find I'm using 6 gallons per 100 gallons of fuel. What's going on? Is something going on? So the thing is that it's going to be an indicator, like you riding by a field and seeing something happening with the color of the crop or what have you. So that's why I think it's so important to become familiar with this, because that is part two of what I'm talking about today, is that to have to be cognizant or in lockstep with the amount of usage, DEF, diesel exhaust fluid usage, that engine uses on a traditional basis, on an average. And then the other thing, basically, which was the first thing, I'm going from 2 to 1, like a beauty pageant, right? I'm counting down. And the thing is that there is really nothing written that I could ever find, nothing said, nothing spoken about, and everything is so cursory. Oh, there's diesel exhaust fluid, it sprays it in there, blah, blah, blah. Some people, pardon my French, think it's cow piss. I mean, the stuff that you hear is unbelievable. And, there's a guy here in town who bought a new Duramax a few years ago, and his salesman told him, you know, save an old soda bottle or something, plastic bottle, and keep it underneath the seat. This guy just bought a $75,000 truck. And if you ever run out of that urea, they call it urea, but it's really diesel exhaust fluid, because it's urea mixed with water, deionized water. He told them, take a leak in a bottle and dump it into the DEF tank. And this is not urban myth. This is real. I mean, that's the stuff that goes on out there. So, lack of understanding. So the thing basically is that nobody's talking about how to diagnose the system. Now, there is going to be a caveat that I am going to attach to this, and I'm not trying to escape or cover my rear end with this, is that there are so many different systems that it's going, and the farm environment has pickup trucks that have Tier 4, they have skid steers that have Tier 4s, they have sprayers that have Tier 4, they have red tractors, green tractors, blue tractors, right, and they all have to accomplish the same thing, which is the tailpipe emissions need to be clean, but they go about it slightly differently. So I'm going to give you a generic overview of the understanding. And what I'm talking about here is that just like if you have a carburetor and you're not getting, and the engine doesn't want to start, it could be a Holley carburetor, it could be a Carter carburetor, it could be a McCooney carburetor, it could be whatever. It could be a carburetor on a lawnmower. If the spark plug is dry, you know it's not getting fuel. And you have to determine why. So I'm going to give you a spark plug is dry overview, and then you could apply that to the type of system that you have in that particular Tier 4 application. Alrighty? So now what we're going to do is we're going to back further up. All right? There is a, as far as the Tier 4 emissions is concerned, I'm not going to get into it. I did a show a while back, and you could reference it in my archives. But the SCR system, selective catalytic reduction, is going to be the last piece on the It's going to be the last stop on the train from the exhaust before it exits the tailpipe. So if you look at any type of Tier 4 engine, the first thing that it's going to be in the exhaust system is the diesel oxidation catalyst. The next thing is going to be a diesel particulate filter, and then if so equipped is going to be a SCR, selective catalytic reduction. So those are the three components, and those are the order that they're going to be in. You're not going to find an SCR nearest the engine. The SCR is going to be the last thing that the exhaust is exposed to. All right? And now what happens is that what is the purpose of the SCR? Very simply and succinctly, it is to control one emission, selective. Just like a selective weed killer, it's going to control one type of weed, a family of weed, a grass or a broadleaf, right? So what the SCR does, its whole purpose in life is to eliminate an emission called oxides of nitrogen. So it's NOx. So it's oxides of nitrogen. It's not nitrous oxide. I know there may be some chemists out there listening to it, and some people could refer to that as, but its proper name is oxides of nitrogen. And what oxides of nitrogen do is they create photochemical smog. Okay? So it's a very bad and poisonous pollutant. Now, there are three things that need to happen inside a engine, a combustion event, for to create oxides of nitrogen. All right, and the person who discovered the equation for this is a Mr. Zeldovich. So it is called the Zeldovich equation, and his name is Zeldovich, Zeldovich. So it's called the Zeldovich equation. And in simplistic terms, because we don't need to go any more beyond that, is that you need to have, in the combustion, you need to have pressure, you need to have heat, and you need to have what Mr. Zeldovich calls residence time, but I call it exposure time. So it's heat, pressure, and exposure time. If you have those three elements, heat, and the heat has to be above 2,500 degrees F. So if you have heat, pressure, and exposure time, you are going to create oxides of nitrogen. If you take anything out of that equation, you have heat and pressure but no exposure time, for all intents and purposes, for our discussion, there's going to be no oxides of nitrogen. So it has to have those three things, like baking a cake or baking bread, as those three ingredients for it to rise. And if you look at the equation, it says the leading edge flame front temperature needs to be 2,500 degrees or higher for the Zeldovich equation to prove itself, to be evoked. So that's when it's going to create oxides of nitrogen. Now, as an aside to this, a lot of power plants use a exhaust fluid, we'll call it. It's not DEF, that's a higher concentration of urea, because they create oxides of nitrogen. If you're cooking with a barbecue grill, all right, you're going to be creating some oxides of nitrogen, but there's no pressure there. There's heat, and there may be exposure time, but no pressure. So heat, pressure, and exposure time is what creates oxides of nitrogen. And the SCR, selective catalytic reduction, the last stop on the train before the exhaust goes into the atmosphere, the furthest back from the engine, is where that's going to be handled. And that has if you look inside an SCR, all right, it has a monolith. It looks like a gasoline catalytic converter. It has special precious metals in there that interact with the exhaust when this diesel exhaust fluid is introduced into that stream. All right, so that is what it's going to do. We're not going to get involved with the chemistry. I'm not smart enough to explain the chemistry or even understand the chemistry. Now, what is going to happen is that, let's talk about what is going on in that, for that SCR, and you're going to see how this makes sense. Is that, you know, we raise sweet corn, and you know that before, but I'm telling for new listeners, we raise sweet corn. And if I don't put a pre, and I don't raise a GMO type of corn, right? So if I don't put a pre down in my field, then I use Lumax, all right? If, not the Lumax, I use Acuron. I used to use Lumax. But anyway, Acuron, and the thing basically is that that field is going to dirty up very quickly, and it's going to be full of weeds. Now, today in agriculture, a lot of guys don't use a pre. They're starting to, right, back again. But when glyphosate became on the market and became popular, the guy would plant, he'd wait for the fields to get dirty, go in there and hit it with glyphosate, and then he would clean the field up. All right, we all know that. He used no pre. So think of this, is that when you have, the whole goal is that where is the source of the oxides of nitrogen emissions? The source of the oxygen nitrogen emissions, oxides of nitrogen emissions, is the combustion event inside the engine. So this all begins inside the engine. So the thing is that if you have a higher level of oxides of nitrogen emission, then what's going to, then something is happening inside that combustion chamber that is now producing more oxides of nitrogen. And then what is going to have to happen, just like you have to go into the field, if the field isn't too dirty, you say, well, I could put a quart per acre, I could put a half a quart per acre of Roundup, of glyphosate, and clean up that field. You say, man, that field is dirty. There's a lot of escapes in there. There's a lot of heavy, there's a lot of penetration, there's a lot of pressure in there. I got to go full rate, 2 quarts per acre. Well, the thing basically is that think of it the same way with the diesel exhaust fluid. If the engine is now producing more oxides of nitrogen, then the Roundup or the glyphosate, whatever you want to call it, the weed killer, is the diesel exhaust fluid. So this system is going to introduce a higher rate of diesel exhaust fluid, 2 quarts per acre, right, instead of a half a quart per acre, because there's more escapes, there's more weed escapes, and in this particular sense, the weed escapes is oxides of nitrogen in parts per million. It's not weeds growing in your field. So a good combustion event, a proper combustion event, will limit the amount of oxides of nitrogen being produced, and thus, in turn, will limit the amount of diesel exhaust fluid that is being consumed, because it is not, doesn't have to clean up a lot of weeds. So think of the oxides of nitrogen as weeds. Now, the thing basically is that the industry has defined and has more or less a standard of saying that on that it's an engine is going to consume, or let me put it this way, that a system will consume between 2 and 5 gallons of diesel exhaust fluid for every 100 gallons of diesel fuel consumed. So it's between 2 and 5%. The earlier SCR systems, when they first came out, were consuming between 2 and 3 gallons of DEF per 100 gallons of fuel, and then the later ones, because they lowered the emission standard, so they got to put more Roundup in a tank, right? More weed killer, there's more weed. We want this field cleaner than it was the year before. So they raised what they call the dosing rate of the diesel exhaust fluid, and it'll be up around 5 gallons per 100 gallons of fuel delivered to the engine, that the engine consumes. So now, let's stop there for a minute and let's divest. Now, what's going to happen is that the load that the engine is under is going to determine, because remember, it's pressure, heat, and exposure time. So when you're loading something, you're pulling a strip till machine through the field, all right? You're pulling a strip till machine, you got a big wide strip till machine, you're pulling a big air seat or what have you, and you're really working this engine. So the load on the engine is going to determine the amount of dosing of the diesel exhaust fluid. Now, how does it do that? Well, it's what they call a PID loop. And in a PID loop basically is a feedback circuit. A fuel injection engine has an oxygen sensor. It's a PID loop. You have a grain dryer with a sensor. It's a PID loop. You have an auto steer system where it's going and it's looking off a satellite and it's tracking to drive the tractor or the combine. That's a PID loop. And what PID stands for is proportional integral derivative. Proportional integral derivative. So that means it's a feedback circuit. It's controlling something. It sees that it's not where it should be, and it sends a signal somehow to correct it. So if you're going down the road and you're driving your pickup truck, forget about it, it's a 1964 Ford. And right, you're going down the road and you're driving your pickup truck, and the fact of the matter is that now you're starting to wander off to the side, all right, and towards the ditch. So what you do is you take the steering wheel and you turn it the other way. Well, you're a PID loop. The vehicle, because of the high crown of the road, is veering towards the ditch. You recognize that it's veering towards the ditch, and you turn the steering wheel to the left to correct it and bring that old Ford back up onto the crown of the road and not go into the ditch. So that is a PID loop. So what happens is that the SCR system uses an injector, which is akin to a fuel injector. It is not the fuel injector. It uses an injector, and it sprays, right? It has pressure behind it. The fluid is delivered with pressure, and it sprays into the SCR, a atomized spray of the diesel exhaust fluid, and this diesel exhaust fluid then usually they have what they call a mixing chamber, so it becomes homogenized, all mixed together, and then it reacts with the oxides of nitrogen, these precious metals in this catalytic bed, which is called a monolith, looks like a honeycomb, and the diesel exhaust fluid, and the chemical reaction takes place, and it goes and it sends the exhaust out into the atmosphere, void of oxides of nitrogen. So what basically happens is that because it's a PID loop, is that it's going to use a sensor, that an oxides of nitrogen sensor, which looks like an oxygen sensor, and if you find your SCR, you're going to see there's going to be one before it and there's going to be one after it, because it's a PID, right? It's a proportional integral derivative, needs to say what's going on. So it's, so the system is going to say to itself, okay, we have X, I'm just going to make up numbers. We have 1,000 parts per million oxides of nitrogen coming in. That's the first sensor. And we need to only have 500. So there's going to be an algorithm in the control module that says, okay, based upon we have that, we need to spray this much of diesel exhaust fluid to interact with the SCR, selective catalytic reduction, to clean up these oxides of nitrogen. And then the sensor at the end says, yes, we're down to 450 parts per million. Then we're all good. The sensor on the end says no, we're still at 500 parts per million. Then what it's going to do, it is going to go and it is going to add more diesel exhaust fluid based upon satisfying that PID loop of that sensor saying yes, it's like an accountant looking at it and saying, yes, you are where you're supposed to be, your books are balanced. So now, to get back on track, is that what is going to affect diesel exhaust fluid consumption? Well, a number of things. First of all, since it all comes from the combustion chamber, if you have an inefficient combustion event or something going on with that combustion event, poor quality diesel fuel, low cetane diesel fuel, dirty injectors, all right, the thing basically is that you're going to have the propensity to build possibly more oxides of nitrogen, or you may build less depending upon what's wrong and build more particulate matter, but we're only talking about SCR right now. So you're going to have the propensity body to build more oxides of nitrogen. So by you monitoring your rate of usage, it's going to be like a fluid test. You take a fluid test on the hydraulic slipper. Say there's some titanium in here. Something's happening with the pump. It's starting to shred. It didn't go bad yet. So it's an indicator of what's going wrong. All right. So that's the first thing. So if you cannot glean that there's something going wrong there, then the thing basically is the next step we have to say is that what type of usage was this piece of equipment under when I used more fluid. So you say, well, I was pulling a strip till machine, a 40-foot wide strip tiller, and heavy ground on a 100-degree day. Well, that's a recipe to make more oxides of nitrogen because you're working the engine, you're using a lot of fuel, you're building a lot of heat, you're making a lot of horsepower, and it's hot outside. So it's the recipe, pressure, heat, and exposure time is that you're going to make more oxides of nitrogen. So you say, hey, when this thing is pulling a strip till in that field over there, those 1,000 acres, this thing uses 5.5-6 gallons for every 100 gallons of diesel fuel. So you have that data in your mind. You don't have to write that down in a book. Now, you take that same tractor and you're using it to pull an empty grain cart. Well, if it's pulling an empty grain cart down the road, it's not going to be working as hard. It's not going to be producing as much power. Thus, it's not going to be producing as much oxides of nitrogen, and it is going to use less diesel exhaust fluid. So now this holds true for everything. I'm using a tractor as an example, but you could have your pickup truck. So you could say, when I use my pickup truck and I use it like a car, I have whatever, 100 pounds or something in the back, I go to town, pick up a bag of feed, I'm able to go so many miles without using much diesel exhaust fluid. Why? Is because the amount of oxides of nitrogen due to the Zeldovich equation was not being produced. Now you hook up a cattle trailer, a fifth wheel or gooseneck cattle trailer, you got it loaded up with bulls, and you're bringing them to a sale, and it's uphill all the way. Well, you're going to be using a heck of a lot more diesel exhaust fluid. So you have to understand this. So the first thing to keep in mind is that what is the operating state of the engine, and once you have enough seat time on this tractor, this truck, this sprayer, you'll understand, then you'll be able to figure out what it's doing there and how much it uses. All right. The next thing basically is that if the situation is the same, and you are using more fluid, then you have to say, Jesus, something's happening inside the engine. Now, keep in mind, most of these engines use exhaust gas recirculation and an SCR. So the SCR, exhaust gas recirculation, is meant to clean up oxides of nitrogen also. So what's going to happen is that if that EGR system is starting to get plugged with carbon, it's not cleaning up the field. It's sending a lot of escapes out to the SCR. So now the SCR is going to have to use more DEF, is all acronyms, right? Exhaust fluid, to clean it up, because the EGR is starting to get carboned up. So by you knowing this, say, man, I mean, the engine could be running fine. I don't care what it's in. No service engine soon lights, no check engine lights, no anything, right? It's running fine. But you say, I'm starting to use more diesel exhaust fluid in the same type of operating state that I had before. Pickup truck, tractor trailer, sprayer, combine, what have you, and you say, then that's probably a pretty good indication. You say, well, it seems to be running fine, so I don't think the combustion vent is wrong, is going skewing on me, that EGR system is starting to get plugged up or starting to become inefficient because you're putting more of a load on the SCR system, all right? So keep in mind that anything that you cannot clean up in the combustion chamber, whenever there's an after treatment on the exhaust, whether it's EGR, whether it's DOC, DPF, or SCR, means that we're trying to clean up what we couldn't clean up in the combustion chamber. So if I have to go back in my field and my pre-emerge didn't work like it did this year, and I had a whole bunch of fall panicum, then that's what's going into your SCR system, not the fall panicum, but the oxides of nitrogen. So by you monitoring this, you'll be able to tell me, man, something's going on here, right? The other thing to keep in mind, so what are the potential areas that will increase the amount of diesel exhaust fluid usage, which should be a telltale to you. We're going to take out of the equation the use of the that particular piece of equipment or truck. You're hauling a load versus driving it like a car. We went through that already. Okay, number one is that the combustion event could start to skew. Number two is the EGR circuit could start to be plugging with carbon or becoming inefficient. Number three is you could be running poor grade of fuel. Number four is that you could have polluted or poor quality diesel exhaust fluid. A lot of systems today have a diesel exhaust fluid quality sensor in them. Not everyone does. I know Detroit Diesel does. Maybe Caterpillar does. Maybe John Deere does. But you have to know your system. You have to know what's on that particular application. So if you have poor quality diesel exhaust fluid and it's either polluted or it's stale or it's outdated, its conversion rate is not going to be the same. So the system is going to try to use more. It's going to try to spray more through that injector because that PID loop is going to say, hey, we're not cleaning this up. We got to do a better job over here. All right? So that is that. And then the other thing that comes into play is the system functioning properly. Does it have a filter? Some systems have a filter on them that says, that like a fuel filter, say, is the filter plugged? Is the pump pressure low? Is the injector itself that they have a tendency because of the environment they work in and how crystallized the DEF becomes when it's left there to evaporate? Maybe the pintle of the injector is not spraying properly and not atomizing, so it's dribbling it in there, so it's not getting a nice in that mixing chamber. It's not getting a nice mixture. It'd be like a fuel injector engine just dripping fuel. It's not a nice homogenized mixture is what I'm looking for. So that is a potential problem. All right. The other thing that comes into play is that is the SCR itself, the catalytic bed, starting to go bad. All right, starting to go bad, which I would say, unless you put some high sulfur fuel in there, I doubt very much that would happen. So it's usually either the engine is producing more SCR, more NOx, oxides of nitrogen, the diesel exhaust fluid has become either polluted or outdated, all right? Be just like using a herbicide that's outdated, all right? Or any fluid that's outdated loses its efficacy, all right? Is the injector not spraying well? Or is the sensor itself lying to it? Because the sensor could skew, and it could be coming out of there so clean that you could put your mouth on it, and then what basically happens is that you go there and the sensor is telling you it's dirty. So those are the different areas that are generic that could have you have a high rate of use of diesel exhaust fluid. But it's very important for you to remember that and be cognizant of that, because it is going to be a telltale of what's going on. Now, the thing is that on big trucks, and you could usually use a scan tool called a J-Pro, but the dealer for each piece of equipment will have some sort of scan tool, and depending upon what they call the serial data stream, it may reveal an injector pulse width or duty cycle on a DEF, and also may reveal a level of conversion of that, so efficacy, efficiency of that supplemental catalytic reduction system. So as we come to a close here with this, and as I always say, I went through it quickly and I understand, but I want you to, I have asked you to forgive me for that, but the nature of the podcast doesn't lend itself to go on for 3 hours. But the fact of the matter is that the important take-home message is here. You need to understand that the operating load of the engine is going to be what's going to be paramount at creating these oxides of nitrogen. Some engines have a combustion event that by nature of their combustion event create more oxides of nitrogen. All right, but once you get through that, it's very important for you to be able to have a cursory knowledge of the operating state state of that piece of equipment, truck, pickup truck, semi, combine, what have you, and how much DEF it burns per 100 gallons of fuel. It's usually going to burn between 2 and 5 gallons, depending upon the application. All right, and the thing is that, and you're going to use that as an indicator of something going astray, and you're going to fix that. You're going to use that as a telltale to fix it before it becomes a very expensive problem. Because as I always say, it's not what you make, but what you keep. And keep in mind that the injector has to be working properly, and the sensors itself can skew. And if those sensors skew, it is going to mess the whole thing up. And you have to have excellent quality diesel exhaust fluid, not stale, not degraded from being out in the sun. And then hopefully in the next couple of weeks, my first on the road with idle chatter is going to be talking to probably the most knowledgeable person about the chemistry of diesel exhaust fluid that there is out there. And I won't tell you his name for now, but then we're going to go into, that's going to be almost like a part two of this, all right, if I could hopefully make that happen. So keep that all in mind. If you have any questions, any concerns, please feel free to contact me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. So now what we're going to do is that we're going to go into our toolbox test. And we always know that before the toolbox test, who has to come sing? Tex Rabinowitz from Ripsaw Records. And from what I understand from Ripsaw is that their new website is almost done, so I'm going to tell you about that when it comes out. But we want to invite Tex into the classroom here because he's going to get us ready to take this toolbox test. Come on in, Tex, sharpen your pencil. And here he comes.
I'm a hot rod man. Yeah, I'm a hot rod man. Look out, little mama, gonna get you.
All righty, Tex. I don't think he has much oxides of nitrogen. He says he's got a clean-running machine there, right? Back when that song came out, you know, believe it or not, when that song came out, I think it came out around 1980, 79 or 80, that we were well into oxides of nitrogen, and that's why gasoline engines had EGR valves. Okay, so we're in test number, toolbox test number 4 from the website, and we're on test question number 1. Like most farmers, you keep old equipment around since it still has some useful life left in it. All right, we all do that. You applied this mindset last year when you bought your wife a new SUV and kept her old one with 300,000 miles on it as a spare. You use the old car to run to town, lend it to the hired man, and as a general backup vehicle. Well, the inevitable happened. The transmission finally went. You had it towed 2 towns over since you heard there was a good transmission man there. He called and said the unit would need to be rebuilt and it would be $2,000. You spoke to your wife about it, and the decision was made to fix the car since you never really put any money into it and you got used to having a backup vehicle. After getting the SUV fixed, you drive it home and the transmission shifts fine, but the engine seems sluggish at low speed and especially away from a stop. You decide to drive it for a few days and maybe things will break in. They don't. So you call the transmission man. He tells you if the unit shifts fine, the problem is with the engine, and have a mechanic look it over. This perplexes you since the performance was fine before the transmission failed, even though the SUV has over 300,000 miles. When you're at the implement dealer picking up some parts, you ask around to see what they think. These are the responses you receive. Farmer A says that just as the transmission went suddenly, the engine must be going too. He said that you were a fool for putting that much money into an old truck and you got what you deserve. All right, that guy's a real prince. Farmer B thinks that the transmission man set the line pressure too low in the unit and that is why the engine seems sluggish. Farmer C says that you got snookered and the man put a junkyard transmission and engine into your truck and kept yours. And Farmer D tells you, D as in dog, tells you to ask the transmission shop if they changed the torque converter. If so, the one they installed has the incorrect stall speed. So those are your basic questions there, I mean, potential answers. And as soon as we get done with the special delivery letter, we will go and give you the answer. Okay, for special delivery, I have a letter that was written to me, and I will read it to you. And it is about a generator, not a generator on a vehicle, but a backup generator for a building. So it says, I have a question about a backup generator. My elderly in-laws are coming to live with us, and the power goes out here quite often. They have medical issues, so my wife and I do not want them to be without electricity. We are looking at a generator, a standby generator type that automatically turns on when the power goes out. Some have horizontal shaft engines, and others have vertical shaft engines. The horizontal shaft engine ones are more expensive and are physically larger. I really enjoy your show and website. If you have any thoughts on these, on this, I would appreciate you letting me know. And it's Frank Schwartz from Nebraska. Well, thank you so much. And I love this because, you know, it's not that the traditional, hey, you know, my pickup truck is doing this or my combine is not charging. So it's about a generator. And that's really, like I say, what, you know, this whole show and everything is about. All righty. To be succinct, I personally like a horizontal shaft engine in a generator or in any application I could use it in for a number of reasons. All right, number one is that when you look at it, when you look at a genset, we're going to talk about a backup generator because that's what his question is about. When you look at a genset, if you have a vertical shaft engine, then what happens is that the generator is underneath the engine, and that's why the enclosure is smaller and it's more upright and it's more compact, and it and they're less expensive to make. I don't really know where the cost saving is, but it's less expensive to make and they're marketed less expensively. What I don't like about that is twofold. Number one is that if you have a problem with the alternator, it's actually an alternator, we call it a generator, but it's producing AC current for the house. If you have a problem with the alternator, you have to pull the engine and separate and the alternator from the generator. Like you'd have to split a tractor to get to the clutch, so you have to split that system, which I don't particularly care for, because when I look at a piece of backup equipment, is that if there's something goes bad and I need to try to fix it, I got no power, and not have to make a whole big deal out of splitting this case, right, and splitting the engine from the alternator. So that's one thing I do not like about it. The other thing that I don't like about it has to do with, excuse me, what is called thermal inertia. And thermal inertia is a term that describes of the rate that heat travels from one area to another. So if you're heating something up with a torch, and you're, let's say, you're going around and you're trying to get a rusted bolt out, and you're going around, you're heating up with a torch, and you're moving the torch around, right? You're trying to expand that area, all right, so the bolt comes loose and to break free that bond of the rust. The thing is that it's what thermal inertia is, basically how quickly and how efficiently heat transfers from one air, from its heat source to another area. Even though heat rises, is that what's going to happen is that because the alternator, the generator itself that's making electricity is going to produce heat. And now we're putting that heat into the engine. And what's going to happen is that at first start, when the engine is first started, you're going to be putting that heat into the generator. So the thing is that heat is a detriment to anything mechanical, anything electrical. So the temperature of the alternator and the temperature of the engine, because of thermal inertia, the one heat going from one unit to another is going to be a lot higher in with a vertical shaft engine, because you're going to have the engine sitting on top of the generator, the alternator. All right, so I don't like that idea that the generator and the alternator are in so close proximity and are constantly bringing heat back and forth to one another, because, like I said, heat is a detriment to any type of mechanical or electrical device. The other thing that I don't particularly care for comes with heat is that traditionally on a vertical shaft engine, where the cylinder head is going to be right next to that generator. Even if it's on a lawnmower, that cylinder head is right next to the base of that lawnmower or on a pressure washer, what have you. Whereas if you have a horizontal shaft engine, that cylinder head is more in the fresh air than being heated by that generator underneath it. So what's going to happen is that the cylinder temperature and the efficacy, the efficiency of the discharge of the temperature of combustion from the to the atmosphere is going to be less, because you can have a superheated environment there because of the generator and the lack of airflow. So if you have a horizontal shaft engine, that cylinder is sitting up more in the air and away from that generator. So for that heating, I don't like it. And that heating is not only going to affect the way the engine runs, its longevity, but it's going to affect, like, the crank seal is going to be to dry out. So if you want to buy this generator and have it last a long time, you don't want it to be put in oil, because if that crankshaft seal leaks, it's going to put oil right down into that generator. All right, so I don't like that. Whereas a horizontal shaft engine, if the crank seal leaks, it's not going to put it into the generator because it's going to drip on the ground, and then you have that cylinder going up into the atmosphere. And also, because of the small enclosure with a vertical shaft, they're trying to make, hey, look, lady, look how compact it is, the size of a garbage can, that becomes a real oven inside that enclosure. When, if you're running that generator, your in-laws are there, they're elderly, they have medical issues, power goes out, you may be running that gen set for 48 hours straight through. You're building a lot of heat in it. So put that all together. And then the last thing on my list, and somebody who works for some of these companies may choose to argue this with me, but I have felt, and I may be wrong, but I have felt that you have less harmonics, less vibration with a horizontal shaft engine than you do with a vertical shaft engine. And what I don't like about these generators, I would put some sort of rubber coupling, like a fluid coupling, like almost like a harmonic balancer to going into the generator. So if you have more harmonics, and I always have felt that a vertical shaft engine has more harmonics, that you're putting more harmonics into that generator, which basically is going to beat up that bearing and is going to, in theory, have a shorter life. Do they put a heavier bearing, a heavier shaft in there? I honestly don't know. I don't think so. But I don't like the what they call NVH, noise, vibration, and harmonics on a vertical shaft engine. I think that the amplitude of it is greater than in a horizontal shaft engine. I don't like to transfer that into that generator itself, that alternator. And the other thing, regardless, is that if you buy a horizontal shaft engine and you buy a bigger one, you could have a two-cylinder versus a one-cylinder. I do not know, I may be wrong, of any vertical shaft two-cylinders in gen sets in backup generators, but I would rather have a two-cylinder engine. It would be more expensive up front. Over time, it's going to last longer, and over time, it'll be more fuel efficient. But then again, it gets back to that harmonics. You're not putting as much harmonics because you're not taking that one cylinder and hitting it with a big hammer and trying to do the four strokes. So you're going and you have the two cylinders, so the firing pulses are going to even out and put less harmonics into that crankshaft and thus less harmonics into that generator. Because remember that you're probably... I may be overkill with this, but I would rather have a two-cylinder. I'd rather have a two-cylinder horizontal shaft engine in a backup generator that I'm investing all that money into, and it's going to be part of the house. So the thing is, those are my things. Now, regardless of what gen set you buy, what brand you buy, or whether you buy a horizontal shaft or a vertical shaft, when that generator is running, what I would do is I would open up the hood, what I call the hood, on the top of that case, and let that heat out. It's going to be a little bit noisier, but you're out in the farm, you're out in the country someplace, it's not going to be an issue, but I would let that heat come up out of there. And that's going to do, whether it's a vertical shaft or horizontal shaft, it's going to make a big difference letting that heat out of there and not cooking that thing into that metal can with no place for the heat to go. The engine will be happier, the electronics will be happier, the aspect of the transfer switch that is there will be happier, everything will be happier. So hopefully I answered your question. So now we're getting back to our toolbox test answer, And remember, the guy had a transmission done, and now that the car, the SUV, is very sluggish off the line and doesn't have, seem to have much power. So Farmer D, as in dog, is correct. The shop changed the torque converter, and the one they installed has the incorrect stall speed for that engine, rear axle ratio, and the weight of the vehicle. In this example, the torque converter is too tight. The stall speed identifies the engine RPM that the torque converter will internally slip to before it mechanically links and transfers the engine power to the transmission. A converter that is too tight, not enough slip, will lug the engine, while one that is too loose, excessive slip, will respond almost like a centrifugal clutch in a UTV. The engine speed will flare up, and then the vehicle will move. So listen, I went long today. The shows are getting longer. I hope you don't mind. I want to try to give you as much value as I can. This is the longest one to date, according to my timer here. It's going to be 1 hour and 14 minutes. I'm going to do my best to make them shorter. But I want to thank you for listening. I hope that you found value in it. And I want you to know that the Hot Rod Farmer is pulling for you, the American farmer and rancher, and my beloved America. Have a blessed day, and thanks so much for putting up with me.